All right, boy, I tell you, that is, it's Funhouse, Topsy Part 3 from the band Funhouse, and it's an amazing song, and it's something that just, it's oozing promise, okay? And I thought about this, I thought about opening up the show today with that song, and I thought, you know, damn it, man, if I'm going to open up the show with that song, I got to be able to deliver. You can't open up a show with that song and not deliver, and you know what? We are going to deliver big time today because we got a hell of a show for you. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. On the back end of the show today, we're going to be talking with Richard Falk. Richard Falk is the special rapporteur for the UN on the occupied territories in Palestine. We'll be talking to him about what's going on in Palestine, in occupied Palestine today, and the contradiction that's erupted between the U.S. and Israel, and his sort of thinking about what's up for the future of all this. But before we get into that, we have a very special segment. I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Sansara Taylor. Sansara has been on the show a number of times, always very provocative, very informative, very inspirational. She's a writer for Revolution Newspaper. She's a revolutionary communist. She also sits on the advisory board of World Can't Wait and is one of the hosts of Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI in New York City. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
Very good. You know, that song has just got me, I won't be able to calm down for about 8 hours now, okay?
Good.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's unusual for you, but...
Okay. Well, we're moving. We're on. Anyway, you are in the middle of a tour called From the Burqa to the Thong, Everything Must and Can Change, We Need Total Revolution. It's interesting. You've been taking this tour all over the country. There's been a lot of controversy, really, it seems there's been a tremendous amount of people being attracted, coming to it, digging into things, and a lot of changes going on around this. And what I wanted to ask you is you start out, a lot of the material for the tour starts out with the statement that if you're a woman, your body is a battleground. Now, quiet as it's kept, that's some very hard truth. But also, amazingly, it's something that rarely seems to generate the kind of rage that you would expect. It's not the commensurate rage that's just out in the open all the time. And I'd like you to give people a sense of the truth about this. Your body is a battleground. If you're a woman, your body is a battleground.
Well, it would take us, you know, a week to go through all of it. But in a basic sense, women, every single bit of being born female, before you even take your first breath, you are destined to a life that is diminished, that is disrespected, that is often very violent, often very dangerous, surely by the fact that you're born female. And it doesn't matter. I mean, it makes a difference where in the world you're born, but this, in the forms that it takes, but it's common. And, you know, everything from the battle for women to have basic fundamental rights, like the right to abortion and to birth control, which is under fire in this country and around the world, to control their own reproduction, the quote-unquote beauty images that saturate societies to such and have such a perverse effect on society as a whole, but young women in particular, where you have epidemics of young women starving themselves, cutting themselves, learning to hate themselves because they don't form to size zero beauty standards. You have 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 4, the numbers vary, women will be raped in their lives. Every 15 seconds, a woman is battered. Every single day in this country, 3 women are killed by their so-called lovers. It's an intolerable situation, and it is one where there's not a commensurate level of rage. And frankly, I think most people are in denial. There's no other section of people for whom it is socially acceptable in the mainstream to deride, to degrade, to make jokes about violence against, to portray as mere objects for the sexual plunder and pleasure of men. If the images of women that are pervasive in society, you know, if a comparable thing was done with any other section of people, people would be outraged. But with women, it's become like wallpaper. And this is part of what the whole point of my tour is, to stage an intervention. Wake up, people. This is not tolerable. And it doesn't have to be this way.
One of the things that actually comes up off of that to me is, you know, it really is. It's just horrendous. We had Kristen Lombardi on the show a couple weeks ago, and she was one of the main authors of this new report on campus rape. and how it's just, it's sort of that wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and there's unofficial sanctioning of it. You know, it's kept quiet. It's, you know, nobody's really ever punished for it, except for the woman who gets raped, who's made to feel that it's her own fault. It's a problem with her, how she's been actually conducting herself, what she was wearing, where she went, things like that. You know, and I was thinking about this point that you just raised, that if there was any other group in society who was so savagely defiled that it would not be accepted into the mainstream. And we've seen this in many cases, you know, from the Holocaust to, you know, to other things, which rightfully should not be accepted. But to accept this this treatment, this systematic and ongoing treatment of women, of fully one half of humanity, is just, to me, it's just mind-blowing. And I was thinking about this in relation to the questions that come up around this, for instance, and the assertions. Nothing angers me more than people who say, look, it's been this way since the beginning of time. It's just human nature. You try to make things better, you soften the edges, but this is the way it goes. There's biological necessity, there's something in women's brains that make them more nurturing and make them somehow, you know, less than men, or in a different position than men, as opposed to seeing that there's two genders in the human race. And even that is, I mean, people need to even bend their mind a little bit around that, you know, in terms of the social function, a lot around that in terms of the social functioning. So can you talk to this question of it's human nature?
Yeah, this is one of the biggest questions that comes up. It's one of the most widely believed notions that there's just, that all of the mistreatment towards women, or all the differences between women and men that society has imposed, that society has enforced, are just a matter of human nature. And this is one of the most widely believed. It is also one of the most patently absurd and unscientific and unsubstantiated beliefs. Human beings, we've lived all kinds of different ways. We're incredibly elastic and adaptable. And now a lot of people will say, if you look through human society, you see thousands and thousands of years on every part of this globe where women are treated as less than men. And they'll look to that and they'll say, well, that proves that it's just human nature. Well, that does not prove it's human nature. That proves that for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, in every culture just about around the world, we've lived in patriarchal societies. And societies that have codified and institutionalized the oppression of women, whether it be feudal societies, capitalist societies, slave societies. But if you dig deeper into history and you go back and you look at the earliest human societies and you look at our relatives in the animal kingdom, you'll see that patriarchy was not something that was hardwired. It you know, in our earliest stages and for tens of thousands of years, much longer period of time than we've lived in class-divided patriarchal societies, human beings lived in relatively egalitarian gatherer-hunter societies where there was no such thing as the institutionalized oppression of women. And there's a lot of particularity to how the oppression of women emerged. It mainly emerged with the division of classes and the appropriation of private property, of socially produced wealth. And then all of a sudden you have a need to determine who's inheriting what. Who's having whose babies? Who's controlling the reproduction of women becomes a social question for the first time in history. This emerged at a certain point in history, and it will also go out of being, go out of existence when we get rid of classes, and as we get rid of classes, and it has to be a driving force in a revolution, a communist revolution, to uproot all class divisions. The liberation of women is bound up, you know, the oppression of women is bound up with the first emergence of classes, and the liberation of women is only achievable through and must be a driving force in a revolution to emancipate all humanity and to end class divisions. And I know I've spoken for a while, but I did want to touch on, you mentioned gender, which I think it is one of the most defining things. I mean, nobody is born on this planet and grows up and thinks, I'm a human being. Everybody, from the day you're born, from the way that everybody treats you, to the tone of voice they use, to the color clothing they dress you in, to what kind of games they encourage you to play, gets conditioned to think first and foremost of themselves as, I'm a male human being, or I'm a female human being. And if it was just natural for there to be grand divisions between men and women, it would not require such a level of enforcement, socialization, and punishment. If you think about it, the biggest insult that men can be called, and the most dangerous thing, one of the reasons for a great deal of violence against men, is when they deviate from what's considered male. You know, if they get called names. I never remember what we can say on the radio, so everybody knows what I'm talking about. When men get called names that refer to them as women, that's the biggest insult. It's saying the biggest violation you can do is to step outside of society's prescribed gender role for you. And vice versa for women. If women act too masculine, if they act assertive, if they act confident, if they play sports, all these things, you know, of course women do them to a certain extent, but they're all discouraged, and then women get called the B word, women become victims of violence for this, women are discriminated against for this. And if this was just natural, it wouldn't have to be so enforced. And there's much more that could be said, but this is a way that people have imbibed and accepted something which is not permanent and not essential to humanity, and something that we need to get rid of. And the obstacle of people believing that it's just human nature, that it's just natural, is one that I speak to very thoroughly, more so than I've been able to here in the talk, and I hope to open up dialogue over with people, because it's really a harmful and unscientific and wrong notion.
Yeah, to me, it's sort of, there is a very interesting answer to this, actually. I thought it was really, really provocative and really gives you a lot to think about. Actually, let me make a quick reminder here. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today I'm talking with Sansara Taylor, who is in the midst of a nationwide speaking tour on college campuses. And the tour is From the Burqa to the Thong, Everything Must and Can Change. We Need Total Revolution. You know, now, Sansara, one of the things, did you ever read Ursula Le Guin?
You know, I haven't.
She has one of her novels. I mean, she plays around. She's one of these sort of, I don't know whether you'd call her an anarcho-communist. She probably would really get angry if I tried to categorize her. But she gets she experiments with all aspects of human existence in her writing. And one of the books she wrote was The Left Hand of Darkness. And in that, she had created a race of people, a grouping of beings that actually had no gender. You know, had no permanent gender. They were permanently sort of just beings. And then when it came time to reproduce, each time of the month, one or the other would become the being capable of bearing offspring. And it just mm-hmm. and if one developed into that, then the other would develop into the other role. And then when the offspring was born, they would actually go back into the way that they were before. She said it was one of the most controversial things she had in terms of the gender bending she was fooling around with. And she said it was also controversial in her own head, because she was sitting there writing and she's got like 8 grandchildren running around her knees. Right? But, you know, I think it's really incredible, this kind of thing that you're talking about, this sort of permanent categorization of people in gender and the impact that has on people's lives. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, you know, you talk about what the solution is, and you talk about revolution, and you're a communist, you're a revolutionary communist. And one of the things that the Revolution newspaper has been running, and these letters are available on the site revcom.us, it's an historic contradiction, fundamentally changing the world without turning out the lights. You know, there's very much related to this, is this kind of, whenever the fight against the oppression of women gets linked to political movements, there's immediately a perceived and oftentimes real kind of wave of puritanical frenzy, you know, that seems to take over, or at least that's how people perceive it. And sometimes, like I said, it's real. And it is related to this thing of sort of like when you're thinking about even not just in movements before there's a revolution, but even after a revolution, there has been some sort of, you know, let's talk about what has happened here, because I think in some places people look at it and say, well, I don't know if that's what I want. You know, it seemed like there was a little bit of puritanism and a little bit of repression where another aspect of women's oppression in relation to sexuality and all of this has been, and experimentation has been, that very vital part of a human existence has been sort of something to be repressed and, you know, basically rejected.
Well, I think this is a really important question. I think Part of the historic bind that we're in is that the way that gender has been constructed, I mean, it flows from the economic foundations and social relations of society, but then it gets deeply internalized. Gender, sexuality, these are things that get to the core of how people perceive themselves as human. They're not innate. They change, they're adaptive to different time periods and different societies and different cultures. But when you're living in them, you don't know that. You just this is how I feel. This is who I am. This is what my existence is. This is what I'm attracted to. This is what I'm turned off by. And so, you know, there's on the one hand, it feels innate. And on the other hand, everything about the way that gender and sexuality is processed in the world today, in this highly developed imperialist world with its networks of you know, commodification in this country and exploitation in this country and around the world, and the relations of domination between countries, everything about the way that the intimate is experienced is stamped with the relations of exploitation and domination and subjugation of the larger world. Even though they don't feel like they are, they just feel the way that they feel on the individual level, they're stamped by that. If you look at the way that sexuality is largely portrayed in the culture, it's portrayed as conquest. It's even in the way people talk about sex. I mean, men get some, women give it up. It's in everything about the way we think about sex, the way that we think about women as not as full human beings, but as things. You say, I want to hit that. I mean, people do it all the time. They talk about women as things, and they talk about sex as something that's an exchange and used for advantage, if not for utter conquest and degradation of somebody else. And so the problem is you have most of what people experience as sexuality and the way that they experience gender is stamped with these oppressive relations of domination. And there's been a very legitimate, very correct desire to say, okay, well, we don't want these portrayals of women, and we don't want sexuality that's you know, treats women as inferior. But that's not the same. You know, there's been a tendency, as you were saying, to then, because the imagination, well, two things, the understanding of the source of the problem and the solution of the problem, and the imagination that is required in the space and experimentation that's required to kind of uncork and give people some room to bring something new into being. The imagination has been impoverished because the understanding has been impoverished, and so people haven't had the vision of how you could do it different. And there's been a tendency instead to suppress sexuality or to curtail experimentation, and this has gone together in revolutionary movements and in communist movements in particular. And this has gone together with a wrong understanding of what I spoke of earlier when I said, look, the oppression of women emerged with the first class divisions. And there's been a tendency in the communist movement to think that, well, therefore, if we just struggle against classes, women will be emancipated, end of sentence, as opposed to actually grasping that the oppression of women, the division into genders, the expression of human sexuality, these are realms in their own sphere. These have to be taken up and handled in their own sphere, and struggle needs to be unleashed around them, and a space needs to be given for there to be experimentation in their own right, actually as a driving force contributing to revolution, and that kind of experimentation and exploration and bringing into being of something new will not actually happen on the scale it needs to without revolution. And so those things are tied, but they're not one and the same. And I think there's actually been a lot of errors in the movement for revolution and in the communist movement in this country, the precursor to the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the Revolutionary Communist Party itself is, you know, our chairman has made a big critique recently, actually looking very soberly and frankly putting on the table shortcomings of this nature in the history of this party here, and also in the history and in the present day state of the international communist movement. And this is one of the things where he's doing path breaking work and actually calling for and leading the way in major ruptures, because the thing that's been correct is that without communist revolution, there's no way to go about the full emancipation of women. But if we don't actually understand this more deeply, more scientifically, and uncork the imagination around what gender can be, around what sexuality can be, about what it would be like if human beings related to each other is fully human, if sex wasn't about getting some, but about interacting with, sharing with, exploring with, being close with, being tender with, being having fun with, somebody who you feel attracted to in a mutual and respectful way. And there's a whole range of human sexuality that needs to be, you know, sort of unfettered from the stamp of domination and oppression that pervades this society. But it needs to be done in a way where people have the space to come to it on their own because it is intimate and it is personal and it is individual experience on that level. And so this is a more complex process than was understood in the past. And it's one of the tremendous things about the leadership of Bob Ovakian that's actually opening up a huge scope for initiative right now to build a movement for revolution that is much more radical and much more liberating than anything that's ever been, and to actually have that revolution lead to a society, to a revolutionary society, and towards an emancipated world in a way that frankly has never even been imagined before, nor has it ever been so possible. And this is, all of this I think is incredibly exciting. Obviously, I haven't exhausted what can be said about it, but hopefully this gets at some of what you're speaking to.
Yeah, definitely. I want to live where you've been talking about, okay? That's where I'm going. I'm going there right after the show, okay?
Well, you're invited.
Okay.
A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today we're talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's currently on a tour, a nationwide campus speaking tour, titled From the Burqa to the Thong, Everything Must and Can Change. We Need a Total Revolution.
One of the things that comes up, you know, and this is, I mean, look, part of this, a lot of people look back at the 60s and they talk about, well, you know, this is one of the places in time where this kind of, you know, experimentation with sexuality and gender and everything else and relationships really broke open, but that it actually ended very quickly and oftentimes in bad places. But then when you look at that happening, and then when people look at socialist societies or they look at what communists have done in socialist societies, there's a question of, it gets linked to the question of morality on both ends, you know, and the idea that, not the idea that there's some kind of universal morality, but that there is communist morality, and communist morality is not puritanism. And it's really linked to, a big part of this is actually this idea of that essential to what, like Ovakian has been talking about, that the emancipation of women is not, the fight against the oppression of women is not just about emancipating one half of humanity, but it's vital. It has a critically important place, a vital, crucial place in the emancipation of all humanity. You know, and that this idea of one of the key things you have to do there is not just break with all the various relations and production relations, social relations and class relations, but traditional thinking is really huge, and that this struggle against the oppression of women can continue to play a role in hammering at that and really, you know, revolutionizing society. I mean, that's one of the things I found really, really thrilling about what Ovakian's been doing around a lot of this stuff around unresolved contradictions.
Yeah. Well, just for listeners to have access to what we're both referencing, is there's a new talk from Bob Ovakian that's available on revcom.us. It's called Unresolved Contradictions, Driving Forces for Revolution. And it covers a lot of different things, but the last third of the talk, it's a big section where he really goes more deeply at the question of the emancipation of women as a driving force for building the movement for revolution now and for keeping the revolution moving forward after the seizure of power, and to make sure that it does lead to the emancipation of humanity as opposed to settling in or going backwards. And I think this is theoretically and philosophically a tremendous breakthrough in the history of the communist movement and of the science of revolution, to actually grasp. All the time people say, well, you know, sure, you make revolution, but who's to say once you're in power you won't just turn into those you're fighting against? There's a lot of levels to the answer to this question, but most fundamentally I think that the main problem with people who've been genuine revolutionaries, whether they've made revolution or whether they've started on the path and tried to make revolution, but then eventually got derailed or went in some other direction, is not that they had bad intent or that they just got power hungry. It's that they didn't understand very deeply or deeply enough some of the very contradictions of what it takes to change society and to keep it moving forward. It's easy to see. Everybody acknowledges that there's huge inequalities in the world. But to actually understand not just how to criticize, but to lead a new society, to run a new society in a way that has space and initiative for diverse sections of people, but keeps things going in an overall direction towards emancipation, towards abolishing classes and the division between different nations and nationalities and the oppression of women by men and the division between those who work with their minds and are trained to do so and those who are locked out of it. To keep things moving in that direction takes a lot of science and a lot of understanding for how you handle all those contradictions at once without losing it or resorting to crude methods. And so this is a long way in, but it's the context in which this question of the liberation of women as a cornerstone, as a driving force in revolution, is approached by Chairman Avakian, where he talks about, and he's done tremendous work on this over the decades, but after you have, I'll skip to after a revolution. When you actually make a revolution, there's people who are dispossessed, people who can't live another day with the world as it was. And there's a whole realignment of society around those, the revolutionary people and its leadership, the vanguard party. After a revolution, and you know, even a few years in, the people who were dispossessed aren't also dispossessed anymore. You don't overcome all the oppression and all the divisions all at once. But people who had no stake in keeping the world the way it is, some of them start to have a stake in it. And so one of the things that Avakian has talked about is that you have to look for those forces who are going to continue to protest, who are going to continue to insist on change, who are going to continue to say, hey, you promised you would liberate us. You promised you would put an end to this. You promised you would change that. You want to unleash that. You want to see that as a positive side, a positive element of the unresolved contradictions. There are some things we can do right away when we have state power. We will actually, the kind of thing you were talking about earlier, the pervasiveness of rape on the college campuses. I read that report that said that 90% of the women who are raped on a college campus are raped by somebody who's raped before, but they weren't kicked off the campus. And so, you know, that tells you right there, those are some things we could solve. 90% of the women being raped, 1 in 4 women on college campuses being sexually assaulted, you could end almost all of that just by changing your policy. When we have state power, that would be done. We'd also change the culture. We'd change the images of women that are portrayed. The images of sexuality would be you know, uncorked in the way that I was talking about before. So some things you could do right away. And the same thing around national oppression, the oppression of black people or Latinos or other sections of people who are oppressed. There's some things will change right away. Discrimination in housing will be over. In health care will be over. In education, we will change those things. But then you want a situation where some of the things, attitudes, social attitudes, there's a lot of things that take a longer time to change. You can't change overnight, and you can't just change by saying, we changed it, we passed a law, this is no longer allowed. Some things take struggle, turmoil, a lot of debate, a lot of wrangling, and some time for people to air things out. And in that context, you really, if you really want to get to the emancipation of humanity, and this is what Avakian has, this is one of his breakthroughs, if you really want that, then you want people who are impatient at the rate of change, people who are saying, you promised you would put an end to the oppression of women and that we wouldn't be viewed this way anymore, and you know what? It's not going fast enough. And you want that challenge because it keeps you from settling in. And you want that clashing up against people who say, well, we would like to, you know, we'd like to make those changes right now, but we'd like to pay attention to that contradiction right now, but there's imperialist armies who are threatening to invade us, and we have to build up, you know, our strength to defend this socialist society. Or other people saying, well, we really need hospitals. We need to put our attention on that. And you want people to themselves be raising their demands and making their critiques, but also engaging with each other. Okay, well, how do we address these things from a higher synthesis? How would we not crap real needs to house people, to feed people, to change the economy and develop this? It's not going to be living off the sweatshop exploitation of the rest of the planet. That's not going to happen when we have a dictatorship of the proletariat. How do you address these problems in a way that takes into account the challenges around the role of women, or takes into account the challenges of the national oppression and how to transform them in the process? And it's a different way at this, but it's actually grasping that you cannot get to communism without completely liberating women. And in fact, that continuing challenge will be a driving force and a positive thing all the way through, so you don't settle in, go backwards, or turn into what you promised you would get rid of.
Sansara Taylor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks, Michael.
And as always, really provocative, really insightful, and really inspiring. I really enjoy talking with you, so we're going to have you back much more often, so get ready.
We've been speaking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, who is currently on tour with a speech titled From the Burqa to the Thong, Everything Must and Can Change, We Need Total Revolution, a really unique, unprecedented piece of work on the oppression of women and the solution for it. We're going to take a little bit longer break than usual because I want to play a full song. It's a song by Everlast. It's called Stone in My Hand, and it's from his album Love, War, and the Ghost of Whitey Ford. It's very apropos for our next segment of the show, so listen up, and we'll be right back with Richard Falk, the UN's special rapporteur for the occupied territories of Palestine.
Suffers, every mother cries. So if you had enough and are ready for your stand, I'll be waiting with a stone that's in my hand. Stone in my hand, stone in my hand. Yeah, I'll be waiting with a stone that's in my hand.
Welcome back. That was Stone in My Hand from Everlast and his album Love, War, and the Ghost of Whitey Ford. Joining us now to talk about the situation in occupied Palestine is Richard Falk.
Professor Richard Falk is the UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Palestine Territories, and he's the visiting distinguished professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Previously, he was the Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law and Practice at Princeton University. And the last time we spoke to him on the show, he spoke to us from a parking lot somewhere in Brazil talking about the Gaza War. Richard, welcome to the show.
Glad to be back with you, Michael.
Good. Well, let's jump into this. It's been a year and a half since you were refused entry into Israel and the occupied territories, and just before the completely criminal war that was unleashed against the people in Gaza. And you haven't been able to visit since then, but you are able to keep up with all the duties that you have as the special rapporteur for the UN and documenting the human rights abuses and what's happening to the Palestinian people there. What have you found in terms of the conditions of the people and the human rights abuses by the Israeli regime since then?
Well, unfortunately, the abusive, oppressive occupation of Gaza, which includes a blockade on vital necessities like food, medicine, and fuel, and since the attacks, also a blockade on building materials, the situation of the 1.5 million people living there has continued to deteriorate. Their mental and physical health is at a crisis stage. All the observers from the UN and elsewhere have consistently reported that this is a humanitarian catastrophe that unfolds day by day and is a scandalous ordeal that the rest of the world more or less observes, if not is complicit in the manner that the United States and the European countries are, because they have more or less been supporting the Israeli policies toward Gaza. The situation in the West Bank is also very unfortunate from the perspective of the Palestinian people living there. The Israeli settlements have continued to expand at an accelerated rate, both on the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. There is a difficult life for the people, nighttime intrusions by Israeli security forces, always living with the threat that Israeli violence will produce casualties, Israeli use of force against peaceful demonstrations at the separation wall that has been unlawfully constructed on Palestinian territory. And unfortunately, the litany of wrongdoing in terms of the occupation could continue almost indefinitely, but these are the high points, I think. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today we're talking with Professor Richard Falk, who is the Special Rapporteur for the UN responsible for reporting on the conditions of the people in the occupied territories of Palestine and the human rights abuses by the Zionist regime in those territories.
Now, one of the things that's happened that I think probably caught a lot of people by surprise is that, on the one hand, a lot of your work has been greeted with intense anger and vitriol from the Zionist regime, but you've also recently come under attack from the Palestinian Authority as well. And I should make clear that the PA has been pretty hideously slavish in its capitulation to Israel and the U.S. around all this. Can you tell us what happened with the Palestinian Authority, what it was, and what was behind it?
Well, it's not entirely clear because the attack has not been articulated in any kind of principled way, and it was indirectly, I think, a reaction to the fact that I was somewhat publicly critical of the PA in the manner in which it responded to the Goldstone report, and because it did not really do enough to oppose the Israeli attacks on the people of Gaza. And I believe that the response, the critical response from the PA is partly a result of their sensitivity to any criticism and partly a result of the fact that they object to any acknowledgement of the Hamas role in providing the governmental authority that does exist in the Gaza Strip. And so I think those things, what they have apparently been saying to people is that I have not been able to travel to the region and therefore I can't be an effective special rapporteur, or they've been saying that my health is failing, which is untrue. A variety of things, because they don't want this controversy to be a matter of public encounter, because they had hoped that I would resign under this kind of pressure, but my own feeling is that that would be a mistake, particularly because the Human Rights Council now includes the United States as a member, which means that it's very unlikely that a voice representing the Palestinian people would be selected to replace me. And I think the importance of this position is that in view of the failure of the Palestinians to have adequate representation within the UN system and internationally, it's very important that some kind of public intellectual who is dedicated to telling the truth, even if it's awkward for the political actors, continues to occupy this position. So that's why I have not been willing to resign, even though it's a very burdensome and in many ways frustrating position.
Yeah. Now, one thing, too, that the PA also, the Palestinian Authority also did a, they made a move where they said, look, Richard Falk, special rapporteur for the UN on occupied territories, they basically said, look, you know, we don't want his report. We want to postpone discussion of your most recent report on Israeli human rights abuses in the occupied territories. And, you know, that going along with, I wanted to get your opinion on that, but also you mentioned the Goldstone report, which has also been suppressed by the Zionist regime in a huge way. I mean, there's been such vitriol against it. It's like, you know, it's incredible when you read the way that this is just, that Goldstone is pilloried, that you're pilloried. And, you know, and in particular, the unity, there's some kind of strange unity between the Palestinian Authority and what they're doing with you and the Zionist regime and what they're doing with the Goldstone report. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, Michael, you raised very delicate, important issues that are at the core of my own frustration in this position. There's a little different. I mean, Goldstone is a very peculiar target for this Zionist vitriol that you describe, because he is himself a dedicated Zionist and has close ties to the Israeli established order, family ties and institutional ties. He was a member of the board of trustees of Hebrew University and is a practicing religiously devout Jew. Now, I'm much more secularized, despite being Jewish myself, and proud of that identity, but not, I've never felt that the Zionist way of expressing that identity was acceptable, because it, at least as embodied in the Israeli state, it has meant the oppression of another people. And not only the people that live in occupied Palestine, but the Palestinian minority in the pre-1967 Israel, which is approximately 1.5 million people. Their reality is totally ignored, even though they've suffered a great deal as second-class citizens that are often the targets of ethnic and religious abuse. But the convergence of views between the Palestinian Authority and the official Israeli governmental authorities and their societal supporters is, I think, a reflection of the difficulties that the Palestinian people face in their struggle for self-determination. They just don't have the kind of representation that allows them to put forward on an international level positions that really represent the interests of their people. And the Goldstone Report was a very dramatic example of this, because here was a very authoritative set of findings that confirmed the allegations of criminality associated with the attacks on Gaza of last December, what the Israelis call Operation Cast Lead, and to have this these allegations confirmed by such an respected fact-finding mission should have been greeted with great enthusiasm by the representatives of the Palestinian people. But instead, the Palestinian Authority, at least at first, joined with the Israelis in trying to bury the report within the UN bureaucracy by deferring its consideration. And that's similar, I believe, to the treatment of my report, which is much less visible and salient internationally, but represents, again, an attempt to vividly portray the realities of the Israeli occupation. So this is a very unfortunate part of the overall Palestinian story. But fortunately, there is a Palestinian struggle that is assuming a global scope and has gathered a great deal of political momentum through the so-called BDS campaign, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign, that is providing a kind of grassroots reinforcement to the Palestinian struggle and has begun to resemble the anti-apartheid movement that was so successful in bringing an end to South African racism.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today we're talking with Richard Falk, who is the special rapporteur for the UN responsible for the conditions of the Palestinian people in the occupied territories of Palestine.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, and I think that's very important. I know you. I found it very provocative, some of your thinking on that, because you talk about this whole legitimacy war in the world, which I think is a very important part of what's going on in terms of the people's assessment of and drawing a line and taking sides against injustice and for, you know, the liberation of the Palestinian people. But I also, one of the things that so much seems to today be tied up again, and there's a history to this, a long history, of everything goes into talks. And, you know, there's been for a long time, there's been the idea that, well, there'll be two states, which you make some very interesting points on that. And I'd like you to talk to that. And also the question of, you know, other people have advanced the idea that, well, no, there's one state. And you raise some very interesting and provocative problems with even that conception in the world as it exists today. Can you talk about those things? Because, and I just to give you a sense of this, I also want to ask you your hit on what's going on between U.S. and Israel today. You know, we can get into that after you answer this first question, but especially because what's going on between U.S. and Israel, this whole flap that erupted, again, tied very much into what's going to happen, you know, on the surface anyway, what's going to happen with the Israeli refusal to stop the settlements and the building in East Jerusalem and the continuing talks, you know, the sensitive talks and how that relates to the overall U.S. strategic needs in the region. So we can talk about the first thing first, and I'll rephrase the question, the second one later.
Good. No, that's a complex list of issues that you raise. They go to the really go deeply to the problematic character of the conflict and the difficulty really of understanding it clearly, because there are all these issues that are bound up with any kind of intelligent, progressive appraisal. And the whole issue of what would constitute a just solution to the conflict is really an essential question. And the assumption has been, ever since the UN was founded, really, that the historic Palestine, or the Palestine mandate that had been administered by Britain, should somehow be divided between these two peoples that were inhabiting the territory. And so in that sense, there's been a consensus that has unfolded over this long period now, more than 60 years, that there would be, whatever the equities, the underlying equities might have been, that the only way to move forward was to create some kind of distinct Palestinian and Israeli sovereign political reality. And the 1967 war, in which Israel expanded its territories and began the occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, also produced a famous Security Council Resolution 242 that was unanimously supported, that said there must be Israeli withdrawal, and the expectation was that after Israeli withdrawal there would be a Palestinian state that would emerge in that occupied territory. Now, more than 40 years later, there has been no withdrawal, and on the contrary, Israel has created continuously adverse facts on the ground, adverse to Palestinian self-determination, by constructing these numerous armed settlements, unlawfully transferring their population to the occupied territories, engaging in a series of house demolitions that have made it much more difficult for Palestinians to live in East Jerusalem, and generally created a set of circumstances that now appear to be, as a practical matter, irreversible. And therefore, it seems to be a situation in which the alternative futures are either an oppressive apartheid single state, which somewhat exists today. There's a unified Israeli control over the entire historic Palestinian mandate, but it's administered in a way that subjects the Palestinian portion of the overall population to extreme conditions of subordination in the so-called occupied parts of Palestine, and to discrimination in the Israeli core state. And so the only just alternative to that is a democratic, secular Israel-Palestine that provides equality for all the residents, creates some kind of binational political community, and implicitly is a state without an ethnic identity. And this, of course, implies the abandonment of the fundamental Zionist project of establishing a Jewish state. And most people who have observed and studied Israeli public opinion think that that abandonment is so implausible politically that it would produce a civil war if that was attempted by any kind of Israeli leadership, or it would produce armed resistance if there was an attempt externally to impose such a solution. So one seems to be faced with this dilemma of the two-state outcome being no longer really viable, and the one-state alternative being confronted by these very formidable political obstacles.
Richard, we're gonna have to wrap it up. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I tried to hold the hands of time back, but didn't work, man.
Anyway, no, you asked difficult questions that I couldn't answer briefly.
I appreciated it very much. I the purpose is to ask questions that'll actually get us all thinking, and you've helped quite a bit on that front. So we will have you back again soon.
Good, Michael.
Okay, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You too. Bye. I'm Michael Slate, and you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Professor Richard Falk, the special UN rapporteur for the occupied territories in Palestine. And I want to thank Teddy Robinson, my engineer, Henry Carson for production assistance, and all of you for tuning in. And remember, the world does not have to be this way, but it's up to us and what we do in order to change it, to bring about something that's different. There's no permanent necessity for living the way that we're forced to live these days. So let's think about it. And on the relation to that, on the tip to that, you can write to me if you want at michaelslate@redfuture.com, michaelslate@redfuture.com. But I want to go out with a song I thought a lot about, and that's Forever Young. It's from The Pretenders. And think about it. Stay forever young. Never let them shut you down. Always reach for the stars, because the world doesn't have to be the way it is. That's it. I'll talk to you again next week.
Know the truth and see the light surrounding you.